when I pull, otherwise when I pull this up, there's like a 50-50 shot that I'll be like.
Okay, so recap of what we were doing last time, which is we did segmentation and segmented paging. So I said paging is the operating system's view of how it wants to deal with the process. I chop it up into fixed size chunks called pages and assign pages to page frames, get rid of fragmentation. It doesn't gel very well with the compiler's view of the process, which is that a process has a code segment, a heap and a stack and so on. And segmentation actually looks at how to allocate memory using these segments within a process. And we said if you do that, you allocate memory in arbitrary size chunks, so you get fragmentation. We saw how to combine segmentation and paging. Okay, that's where we left off. Before we start today's class, we will do another story like last time. So this one is the drunk and the lamppost. I presume you heard of the drunk and the lamppost. Okay, no? Well, yes, that's the one. Okay, so there is a reason we are going to go through that, and we will look at the moral. So for those of you who don't know what the story is, I'm going to do the hare and the tortoise at some point. Hopefully you won't make me tell you what it is. Okay, so the drunk and the lamppost, the story goes as follows. This person comes out of the restaurant, he's drunk. He loses his car keys, so he starts looking for it. Some another person comes by, says, "Let me help you." And they start looking for it. They don't find it. And then the person asks him, "Are you sure you dropped it here?" And he says, "No, I dropped it at that location." So then the guy asks, "Why are you looking for it here?" He says, "The light is better here." So then the question is, what do we learn from this story? So the moral is not to follow the hype or the crowd. Okay, so if you are, and this you will often see in terms of courses to take or in terms of topics to pick for projects and whatnot, you might see something that looks attractive and lots of people get excited by it, but the substance may be somewhere else. Okay, so that's sort of the moral of the story. Okay, so that's the end of the parable. We're going to go back to the lecture and do the start talking about demand page virtual memory. Okay, so as I mentioned last time, until now we have assumed that the entire process is going to be resident in RAM at all times. Okay, so that limits what the operating system can do for processes. It limits the number of processes you can start because collectively they have to fit in RAM. Okay, so if you have 4 GB of RAM, that's going to place a limit on how many processes you can start up, because as soon as all those that memory is used up, you are going to basically not be able to start processes. Okay? Now clearly when you are using any machine, you haven't actually, hopefully, you haven't seen the operating system say too bad, out of memory. Okay? Typically this does not happen, and the reason for this is most of operating systems today, not ignoring tablet and phone operating system, most general purpose operating system use a feature called virtual memory. Okay? So what this does for us is two things. One is it gives us an illusion, us meaning the users, an illusion of infinite RAM. Okay? Regardless of the amount of memory you actually have on your machine, the OS is not going to place any limit. It will let you start processes as if there is infinite RAM on the machine. Okay? So you will not realize that you have exceeded your memory limit or anything like that. Okay, so you get this illusion of infinite RAM. Okay, and second constraint that we are going to relax is we will not even place a limit on the size of a process. Okay, we will even let processes, individual processes, be larger than the size of RAM. Okay, so single process can be bigger than RAM. All of the processes collectively can be much bigger than the amount of RAM you have. So we will not place any limits whatsoever based on what RAM, how much RAM you have on the machine. Okay, so you can start large processes, you can start large numbers of processes, all of that will just work fine. Okay? Now the question is, you still need some place to store this processes. Okay? And so what do? We are going to use disk as a backup for RAM. Anything that doesn't fit in RAM, we are going to store on disk. Okay? And we are going to bring contents of these processes into RAM on demand as and when needed. Okay. And that is essentially what demand paged virtual memory means. Okay. Demand paging essentially says we fetch content into RAM on demand. Okay, that's why the term demand paging. And virtual memory essentially says that it's basically we have this notion of logical or virtual memory, which is much bigger than physical memory. Okay, and the way we will do it is we will use disk or some other backing, storage mechanism as a much slower but bigger version of RAM. Okay, so that's really the concept, and we want to see what are the things we need to worry about from an operating system standpoint to implement virtual memory. Okay. So as an aside, as I just mentioned, general purpose operating systems have virtual memory built in. Right? Whether it's Linux or Windows or OS X, most general purpose operating systems implement it. Low-end operating systems, or operating systems rather, that operate on low-end devices still don't have these features. Okay, so I gave the example of phone operating system. Okay, iOS, or for that matter, versions of Android don't actually implement virtual memory. Okay? So in iOS, if you actually start too many applications, the OS silently terminates some of your running processes. Okay? It somehow saves those state into some configuration file, so when you resume that process or application, you don't actually know that it was terminated, but it does do that because you cannot otherwise start processes without telling the user that there isn't enough memory, go terminate something. Yes, question.
Do you know, the main memory of like an iPhone, is that like just like it's obviously not like a hard disk, so is it just like SSD or anything?
So the question is the main memory of an iPhone different from traditional machines? Is it SSD? So typically phones and tablets are no different from laptops and desktops. They have RAM, and it's DRAM, it's volatile, and they have storage, persistent storage, which is like disk, and the only difference really is the disk is SSD. RAM is still DRAM, it's not changed at all. Okay, now laptops also have started having SSD. So my machine doesn't have a traditional hard disk, it has a SSD drive, okay, which is very similar to what you will see in a tablet or a phone or an iPod or some such thing. Okay. So there it won't be any different. You could implement virtual memory if you wanted to. It just doesn't yet. Okay. So how do we go about doing this? So you use memory as a cache for disk. By definition, all the processes that you start up will be resident on disk, and portions of these processes will be fetched into memory, okay, on demand. Okay. Now clearly, if the process starts accessing a piece of its address space that is not resident in RAM, you will have to fetch it dynamically. Okay. You will have to bring it from disk and put it into RAM. Okay. And that is going to slow down the process. Okay. Clearly, if you have what is called a page fault, which is you access a page that is not resident in memory, you will have a trigger what's called a page fault that will cause the OS to go and say, get that page from disk and put it in RAM because the process needs to use it. Okay? So you will do that, but that's going to take, it's going to incur some overhead. Okay? So the more faults you see, the slower your process is going to run. Luckily for us, we will rely on the 90-10 rule for most well-behaved processes, which basically says processes access 10% of their address space 90% of their time. So maybe the first time the process accessed a page, it triggered a page fault. But then there's a high likelihood that many subsequent instructions, hundreds of them or thousands of them, will continue to access that page or some other pages nearby. So fetching that page into memory has actually given us some benefit. Okay, so it will have one, that page fault will get amortized over many, many, many instructions that the process will subsequently execute. Here you had a question.
Yeah, it's kind of an optimization question more than necessarily a real world implementation. Well, yeah, anyway, I know how Windows uses a swap file to store, to do this, and how Linux generally will use a swap partition.
Yes.
And the idea of the partition is it can immediately know where in memory and it's contiguous. Is there any advantage to using the file itself? It seems kind of silly almost because it can become fragmented by the main memory.
Right. So Linux can use swap files as well. Okay. You can create a swap file and ask Linux to swap off a file. And the reason you basically use a swap partition or a swap file is whenever you are accessing a swap file versus a swap partition, you have to go through the file system, which slows it down further. If you directly use a raw partition, you just go to the block and get it. If you use a file, as we will see when we do file system, you have to actually dereference the data in the file to find where the block resides and get it. So swap files are more convenient. They use the space that's already part of your disk file system. You don't have to allocate any special space, but it's slower. There's a convenience versus performance trade-off there. I don't think there is anything that says you can't use a partition. You could if you wanted to, but typically it goes one way or another. You had something to say. Okay. So demand page virtual memory, that's a digression. We'll come back to swap files in a little while. Okay, so this is the new picture to keep in mind. Okay, so you know, your processes are essentially stored on disk as a collection of pages. Okay, we'll still assume that the process is a collection of pages. By default, those pages will reside on disk. Okay, and so this is the logical view of that process. Okay. So this is the address space. Most of these pages will actually be here. Okay? Some subset of the pages, those are the pages that the process is currently working on, which is referred to as the working set of that process. Working set is a set of pages the process is currently accessing. Okay? Those pages are stored in memory. Okay? And the page table essentially tracks where everything is. Okay? What pages are in memory, what pages are on disk, all that is actually being tracked by the page table. Yes, question.
The diagram looks like the working set is also on disk.
Is the working set also on disk? So that's a good point. When I come back, it is indeed true that there will be some pages where there's a copy in memory and copy on disk. Okay? And we'll come back to why that is the case. Why do we need two versus just one copy? Okay. But for now, we don't need to worry about that nuance. Just assume that by default, everything is on disks. All the pages of all processes are on disk. And some subset of those pages, and which is basically the working set of each process, is resident in RAM. And the page table is going to track everything for us. Okay. So before we talk about what happens when there are page faults and so on, let's ask the question, when should you bring in pages? Okay. Into memory. Okay, so when you start off, we'll say there's a copy of every page that this process owns on disk. Okay, so there are many different points in the life cycle of a process where you can fetch these pages. Okay, so first one is where you fetch all the pages at process start time. Okay, this is basically not virtual memory. This is simple paging that we talked about. When the process starts, load all the pages in memory and that's where they sit. Okay, you don't have any pages on disk. Okay, so in this case, the address space must be no larger than the size of physical one. Okay? And that's the assumption we have already relaxed. Okay? But that's one time you can bring it in. The other way to decide what to keep in RAM and what to keep in disk is have the programmer tell the OS. Okay? Now, typically, these days, you don't write programs where you actually manage memory. You don't write programs that say, first get this chunk of the process, then get this chunk and so on. Okay? But there used to be a time when you had to do this. Okay? This predates virtual memory. Okay? If you did not have virtual memory, the only way to write a process that is larger than the size of RAM is to explicitly manage memory. Okay? You say, initially when the process runs, I'm going to load this chunk of the process, let it run. When it starts executing the next half of the process, I load that chunk and so on. So the programmer and the compiler actually created executables which had explicit instructions to say this is what you should load in the first phase, then you throw it out back on disk. This is what you overlay it with the next chunk and so on. Okay, that used to be overlaid. So back in the days of DOS, which if you probably most of you don't know much about it anyway, overlays were the ways to actually write applications where the size of the process exceeded size of RAM. Okay, with virtual memory, the OS deals with all of that for us. The programmer, compilers don't need to deal with it anymore. Okay. Request paging basically says the process somehow tells the OS which page to fetch. Okay. Typically, again, you don't write processes that do that, but you could if you wanted to. So these are the two most common techniques that are used. One is demand paging, which says fetch pages the first time they are accessed. Or fetch a page, when the first instruction accesses a page, you fetch it on demand. That's when the process needs the page. So this is to wait until the last moment. The process actually executes the instruction. You find that the page is not in memory. You go to disk, you fetch it on demand. Okay. So this is called demand paging. That basically says gives us this notion of a page fault, which is the first time you access a page, okay, you get a trap it says this page is not in memory, and the OS has to then go fetch that page. Okay, that trap is referred to as a page fault. You are faulted because the page is not resident. So interrupt that occurs, or interrupt or a trap that occurs when instruction references a page not in memory. Our entire goal has to be to reduce the number of page faults, because page faults cause the process execution to slow down significantly. Okay, because we'll see page faults are very expensive to service, so you don't want too many of them. Okay, and I'll show you some examples in just a moment. Okay, then, so demand paging says wait until the last minute and bring in the page. Pre-paging says the OS can make some intelligent guesses on what pages the OS, the process is likely to need, and fetch, prefetch those pages. Okay, if you implement prefetching on your pages by making some intelligent guesses, you might avoid page faults. So a simple example is if you are executing a process sequentially. Okay, let's say you are, and you see that you have fetched the first three pages, and you have fetched them in order, the OS can say maybe I should fetch the next two because the process will need it soon, and it starts fetching it even before the process actually asks for any or faults on that page. Okay, so if you have prefetched successfully, by the time the process gets around to doing anything with those pages, the pages have already come in, and then there is no page fault to deal with. Okay, so you could do optimal, you could implement optimizations like prepaging to reduce the probability of page fault. Now, remember that the OS will never know for certain what pages the OS may, the process may need. Okay? The process may loop back and start accessing some of its old pages. There's no guarantee that anything, any behavior you observe is likely to persist. So if you make wrong guesses, you will actually hurt the process rather than helping. So that's something to keep in mind. Yes, question.
Yeah, let's just say, like, if it gets like a page that it doesn't need, does the process itself to give up the CPU?
Sorry, what's the question? If you don't,
if the OS gets a page that the process doesn't need, does the process have to give up CPU?
So the fetching of pages from disk is independent and happens concurrently with the execution of the process. The process is executing, it is accessing some portion of its address space. While that is happening, the OS can send some request to disk and fetch some pages. Okay, so they are parallel or concurrent operations. They don't actually interfere with one another. The only time when the process gives up its CPU is when there is a page fault. You execute an instruction that has a memory address, that address belongs to a page that's not in memory. Okay? Then your page fault, you give up the CPU, the OS goes and starts fetching the page from disk. We'll see how to service page fault. Okay? That's when you have to give up the CPU, not when you're doing pre-paging. Okay? So the thing to keep in mind is if you do this well, you improve the performance tremendously. If you get it wrong, you hurt the process because errors might actually cause you to evict useful pages. Okay? There's only so much memory to go around. If you fetch a page from disk, that's going to be at the expense of some other page you have to evict from memory. You can't just keep on bringing pages. Memory will fill up. So if you bring something in, something else has to go out. So you make a wrong guess, you throw out a useful page and bring in a useless page that the process doesn't need right now. Okay, and you may actually increase your page fault rather than decreasing it if you get it wrong. Okay, this is something to keep in mind. Okay, so now we'll talk about the question that was just our implementation of demand paging. Okay? So first we will say that, as I already mentioned, whenever you start a process, we assume a copy of all of its pages are resident on disk. Okay? And we are going to only fetch a subset of those pages and stick them in RAM. Okay? So when you start up, the process has no pages in memory. Okay? Everything is laid out on disk. There's empty page table. You merely get the first page and you start executing the process. Yes, the first page is where the process begins, first page of the code segment, okay, and start executing the process. So the page table is also now going to track which pages are in memory and which pages are not by keeping a bit. Okay, this bit on each entry is going to say, is this page in memory or not? So if it's 1, if the bit is set, it says it is resident in RAM. If it's 0, it says it's on disk. Okay. So now whenever you execute an instruction, okay, you are going to basically, if that instruction has a memory operand, you will check Okay, you will do this in your address translation, the same thing we looked at, page number offset, you index the page number into the page table. If the bit is set, you are done. Okay, then you just resolve it and you do whatever you want with that memory address. If it's not, you are going to trigger a page fault. Okay, and these are the steps you basically have to implement or perform to service the page fault. Okay. So the page fault says the process needs to bring in a new page from disk. Okay, so to do this, you have to first say if a new page needs to come in, which page should I throw out? Okay, so that is referred to as page replacement. We'll look at several policies to do that. Okay, for now, let's just assume you pick a page to evict, and we will not ask the question how do you pick which page to evict. Okay, we'll come back to that. So first you select the page to evict using page replacement. Okay, then you invalidate that page in the page table because you just threw it out. That entry in that page table has to flip from, or the bit has to flip from 1 to 0 saying page is no longer resident. Okay, then you start loading the page that you need to bring in. Okay, and you bring it to the location where this old page was resident. Okay, because you threw out that page, you made some space in RAM, you bring in that new page. Okay. And while all this is happening, you have context switch. Okay, the process cannot execute. It's stuck waiting for its page to arrive. So you are going to, you meaning the OS is going to execute some other processes while this IO is being done. And once it's loaded in memory, you are going to get an interrupt saying page is brought in. You update the page table entry. Okay, and then you continue the faulting process. You continue or resume execution of the process that had triggered the page fault. Okay, yes. So is that clear? I mean, it's fairly straightforward. All we are saying, if you look at the picture, let's say you access this page. Okay, if the page is not in memory, okay, you say, which of these pages should I throw out? You throw out a page. Okay, sometimes you may have to write it back to disk, as we'll see. And then you say, where is that page on disk? Maybe it's here. You take that and you bring it here. You update the page table entry to point to that location, and you resume execution. Okay, so that's basically what's happening. You evict the page, bring in a new page, update the page table, restart the process, resume the process. Okay, so is that clear what I just said? So now let's look at the disk part of virtual memory in a little more detail. Okay, so we have to ask the question, how is that disk managed? What is actually stored there and so on. So as was just mentioned a little while ago, this region of disk is referred to as a swap space. Okay? This is where you are swapping pages. That's why it's called swap page. You're bringing in pages, you're writing pages and so on. Okay? Some operating systems actually have a special partition where they swap off. Okay? Other operating systems just create one large file on your file system, typically hidden from you, and they swap. They actually keep processes in that file. Okay, the data of the process and so on is kept in the file, and that data is fetched on demand. Regardless, whether you have a partition or a file, it's actually this data stored on disk. Okay. Now, the question is, we have to ask the question, how are you going to manage this swap space? Okay, so, basically when you start off a process, all of its pages are on disk, as I said. Okay, so let's assume they are in swap space. Now when you evict a page, let's say there is a page fault and you evict a page, you have to decide what to do with the page. Okay? Now what you do with that page depends on what is in the page, whether it's code or data, and whether the page is what is called clean or dirty. Okay? Let's suppose you are evicting a code page, let's say the page of a shared library or some code from the code segment. Okay? Question is, do you actually have to take what is in memory and write it back to the swap space? Or not? You have something to say?
I think yes, no, because we have a copy of everything on the hard disk and code is not going to change at any point during running.
Okay, that's a good observation. So, suggestion is, or observation is, if you want to evict a code page, there is no need to take that memory page and write it back to disk, because you fetched it from disk some time ago. Code pages are read only, they don't change, so there is no reason to write it back. Okay, yes,
you also. So was your question just related to code? Because you can still have like the heap sitting.
Yes, so you are going to come to data. Yes, so code pages you can just overwrite. You don't have to write them back. Okay? You just mark the entry in the page table as invalid and you just bring a new page and the page gets overwritten. You don't need to write it back. Now let's ask a question about data pages. It's a heap or a stack. Okay. So if you are editing a page from a process that is a part of a heap or a stack, do you have to write it back to swap? Okay, maybe. When would you write it and when would you not write it? Yes.
If any data in that page has been written to in memory, then the page is dirty and it needs to be written back. Otherwise, the page is clean because nothing has changed.
Right.
So the data in memory is the same as the data that's still on disk and we can just scrap it.
Right. So all you need to figure out whether to write it back. Yes, you have something to add to that.
Isn't it expensive to do the read operations to check if it's dirty or not? Wouldn't it be cheaper to write it?
Come
like
again,
if you're reading objects, objects tend to have.
I think it just keeps
overhead.
A flag. Anytime you actually write to page in memory,
okay.
The operator
just
reads
the flag.
So we'll check how to do that. Let's not worry about how to track whether pages are dirty. But let me explain what was just said. So whenever you edit a page that belongs to a stack or a heap, the only time you have to actually write it back to disk is if it has changed since you brought it in the last time. Okay, there is a copy on disk. If the copy in memory is newer, you better write the new copy out. Otherwise, you lost the changes that are made. If the copy in memory and copy on disk are identical, which means the page was not, may was read to but not written to, or read from but not written to, there's no need to write it back. Okay? So, the most expensive thing you can do to service a page fault is pick what a page that has been modified and evicted, because to service that page fault, there are two disk operations you will incur. One to write that page to disk and one to read a new page back. Okay? That is going to be twice as slow. Okay? The better thing you can do is either evict a page that is a part of a code segment, which you know hasn't changed by definition, those are read-only, or you pick a page from disk or not disk, from the heap or the stack, which has not been written to, we'll call these clean pages versus dirty pages. Page that has been written to is called dirty and the page that's not been written to is called clean. So you pick clean pages, then you are better off. That's only one disk operation to service your page fault because the page in memory is just overwritten. You don't have to write it back. Okay? So where possible when you service your page fault, you want to pick clean pages or code pages. Okay? But if you have no choice, you'll have to actually use dirty pages and swap it out and pop in a new page. Okay, so that's basically one point. Okay, how are you going to read and write or swap? So the point is, whenever you evict a page, if it's dirty, you have to first write it and then read something back in. Okay, so you are going to have to either read or write to swap spaces. But here's another optimization. So you can ask the question, when you start a new process, okay, do you want to create a copy of all of its code pages on swap or not? Okay, and an optimization is, since you have a copy of that executable, the machine code, already on the file system, that's where you're reading it from, that's your exe files or the a.out files and whatnot, there is no need to actually construct the code segment specifically in swap space. You can actually swap off the binary that's already sitting in your file system. Okay, that allows you to use the swap space a little better, okay, than not. Okay, and most operating systems actually do this. Yeah, they are actually going to, rather than creating a copy of the code segment in the swap space, they are going to swap off the binary that's already on disk. Okay? So what this also means is, if you start a process, okay, and while the process is still running, if you actually either delete that binary or recompile that process is actually going to crash because the process is still running, it's swapping off the binary. Okay. Is that clear what I just said? Yes, no?
Well, yeah. Actually kind of worrying about scripting.
Sorry, what?
Scripting languages
and these are mostly for compiled languages. When you do scripting languages, you are basically just reading the file and the interpreter is executing it. So that's a different problem. Okay, so let's suppose you have a binary, okay, which is, let's say, Firefox exe. Okay, that's the file system. It says swap. Okay, if you actually execute this, you will basically have the stack, let's say heap. So pages of the stack and heap are on swap and the file system and the code segment is actually just this exe file. Okay, so the logical view of the process is that this is here and the heap and stack are going to be mapped here. Okay, so this is code, this is stack, this is heap. So you are going to swap off the file that is actually on your disk, okay, which is why some pages of the process actually may be residing on your file system direct and swapped off directly the file that is being used to load that process. So if you modify that file or delete it while the process is running, you are going to cause that process to crash. Okay, that is something to keep in mind. Okay, so now you can ask, if you had asked that question, are there two copies of a page? And for code pages, there will always be two copies. There is a copy on disk and there is a copy in RAM. And you can simply throw out the page in RAM. Okay, for data segment, there may be two copies, but the copies may not even be identical if you have modified the one in RAM. Okay, so typically, there will always be two copies. In some cases, the copies may be identical. In some cases, not. Okay, so that's all about swap space. Now we'll talk a little bit about performance of paging. Okay, now, the good thing about demand paging is we have an illusion of infinite RAM. Okay, there is no longer a limit on either the size of the process or the amount of disk you need. Okay, and just to give an example, if you go into a Linux box and do top or do vmstat, okay, or you can just, if you have a Mac, you can just be lazy and just start activity monitor. Okay, you will actually see. So this machine has 4 GB RAM. You will see that the virtual memory is 300 gigabytes. Okay, it's basically saying that the size of virtual memory is only limited by size of disk. Okay, so, and you can see that the actual swap that's used here is not the size, maximum size of virtual memory is just about 2 gig. Okay, and you will see how much swapping is going on. Right now there is plenty, I haven't started enough processes to stress my memory, so you will see that there are hardly any pages being swapped in and out. Most of the working set size of processes can comfortably fit in RAM. Okay. And if you actually look again in this column, this is real memory for each process. That's the actual size of a process. Okay, so you can see, let's sort it. Okay, so you can see that, what is that top process? That's, I think, metadata service. So that metadata service has 850 megabytes of virtual memory. Okay, of that, only 71 megabytes are actually resident in RAM. So most of it is actually on swap space. Same thing with this Java thing, which actually has 500 megabytes resident in RAM. Okay, so substantial part of it is sitting in RAM. Yes, your question. Real memory just says how much of that process is actually sitting in memory. Okay, this is the total size of the process. These many pages are actually resident in RAM. The rest is swapped out on disk. Okay, yes.
So when you're reading these, the used memory tells you how much stuff is actually in RAM, while swap used tells you how much stuff is in the swap space?
Yes.
So right now there's 3.8 gigabytes of data in RAM and 2.36 gigabytes of data that are in swap that aren't in RAM? Is that what that's saying?
Yes, so that's the size of swap space that is actually used. And the reason this is not bigger than this is because you are also swapping off files that are already on disk.
Okay.
Okay, typically, if everything that is here was there, then you would actually have something like 3 plus, so you will have much bigger swap than right. This. But since I said the binaries, you can just directly swap out the file system. Okay, that is not being shown there. Right, so if you actually look at Skype or Word, you are swapping off the actual binary on that is sitting on disk. And this is only the typically the code and the heap segments of most of the process. It's not the rest of the process is actually on your file system.
Okay.
You had some question. Yes.
What is wired?
What is wired? Okay. So wired frames are frames that are actually not going to be paged out. Okay, so typically that's kernel memory. The kernel doesn't want to page itself. So it's just basically stuck. So approximately a gig is wired, so the kernel is allocated some memory and said this cannot be swapped off. It's always going to stay in RAM, yes.
How does it tell you anywhere here how much memory is in swap that's not currently in RAM?
how much memory.
So you're saying the swap used figure is the total brought in.
So this, if you look at each process, these two columns will tell you that, right? This is the total amount, the size of the process.
Yeah.
This is what is sitting in RAM. So what you're asking is the difference of these two columns. You have to sum these two columns and take the difference.
But does it actually give you that number anywhere?
It should. No, I don't think it reports it here. Any other questions here? This is just a quick digression, yes.
Yeah, I'm just kind of confused because, like, you have this virtual memory set that's huge, and the swap space and the use space are only like.
This is the maximum amount of virtual memory the mesh system can use.
So
that's actually the size of the free disk, essentially.
So that's not the actual virtual memory being used right now?
That's the actual virtual memory being used.
All right.
Okay. So the swaps file that was being mentioned is going to dynamically grow as this grows. It can grow up to that size. Okay, so that's just a quick illustration of, and you can do the same kind of stuff on Windows and Linux and actually examine process sizes, virtual memory sizes of the process, swap sizes, and so on and so forth. Okay, but let's talk now about performance. Okay, this is a good scheme in that we have removed a number of restrictions. We have processes that can be larger than size of RAM. The total size of process typically far exceeds the size of total allocation to all the processes, typically far exceeds the size of RAM. But there is a performance hit we are going to pay to fetch data or from this, to fetch pages from swap on demand. And this is going to analyze it for us. Okay? And the reason we are going to see a win despite this performance slowdown is because of the 90-10 rule, okay, which we will formalize some more using this notion of locality of reference. So if you did any class that involved any programming aspect, you must have heard this term, I hope, okay, called locality of reference. We'll define it again. So locality of reference basically says that the process is going to exhibit some similarity in behavior. And there are two types of similarity or locality. One is called temporal locality, the other one is called spatial locality. And typical processes exhibit both kinds of locality. What temporal locality says is if you access a region of memory, if you access a particular address in memory, right, the process is likely to access that same address again in the near future. That's temporal locality, that you access address I, you are likely to access I again. Right? If you think about, let's say, while loops or for loops where you loop back and you execute the same instruction again, that is where temporal locality comes in. Because you executed an instruction now, you loop back and you come and execute it again. Okay, that's the same region you are going to go and hit again in memory. Okay, that's temporal locality. Spatial locality says if you access an address in memory, okay, let's say address I, you are very likely to access memory regions around I in the near future. Okay, so there is spatial locality. And that again comes from sequential execution of a process. Maybe you have an array and you are going and sequentially scanning all items of the array. So if you access array I, then you are likely to access I plus 1 or I minus 1 likely. Okay, or if you are executing a function sequentially, you execute a statement, okay, then you are likely to execute the next one, assuming it's doing sequential. So these are typical program behavior gives us what is called locality of reference. Okay, because of good locality of reference and the 90-10 rule, demand paging is going to work for us very well. Okay, you are going to not have a lot of page one. Okay, if process behavior was completely random, okay, demand paging would have terrible performance. Okay, you fetch a page and then the process next instruction goes and accesses some other random page. You fetch that page and then you go and access yet another random page. Okay, so you cannot predict what it's going to access, and if it's going to access memory in a random way, then we are going to have lots of page faults. Okay, that's going to slow down. The speed of each instruction is going to be speed of I/O. Okay, you are going to have very slow performance. Yeah, we'll see that's typically not the case. But here is this usual analysis that says what is the effective access time, okay, of memory access. Okay, here we are going to ignore, okay, the page tables and so on, okay, simply because it's the speed of disk is going to be so slow that we can ignore some of these things. Okay, so let's assume that the probability of a page fault is P. Okay, that says that P out of 100 instructions are going to fault. Okay. So basically what that says is whenever you have a page fault, then the time to latency to execute that instruction is the page fault time. Okay. And we'll say that disk is orders of magnitude slower than memory. So there is no need to say page fault time plus any memory access time, because page fault time is going to dominate. Okay. And if there's not a page fault, then basically you basically get effect the memory access time to execute that instruction. Okay. So the average access time for any instruction is 1 minus P times MA plus P times page fault time. Okay. Now typically memory access times are in order of nanoseconds. Okay. So typical 200 or 100 nanoseconds. Page faults take milliseconds, okay? Several orders of magnitude, okay? Millions of times slower. Okay, so typical page fault may be 25 milliseconds is probably off with today's solid state drives. Those are down to 1 or 2 milliseconds, but still, okay, let's think of nanoseconds versus milliseconds. Okay, so this ratio, the page fault probability has to be really, really small for the effective access time for the process to execute as if the process were completely in memory at all times. Okay? This has to be a very rare event. Okay? So we want the process to run as if page faults don't occur at all. Okay? Then the process is running full steam. Okay? And that can only occur if the page fault, because the page fault time is orders of magnitude slower than the memory access time, the probability also has to be orders of magnitude lower than the probability of not having a fault. Okay. So this has to be something like 0.0001, some such number, very small number. Okay. So it do not significantly slow down a process. Okay. Is that clear? Okay. So there's a small question here which says, what effective, if you want the effective access time to be only 10% slower than the memory access time, what value must P have? Okay, so this question says, what probability, what page fault rate should the process have to have no more than a 10% slowdown as a result of faulting? Okay, so there will be of course some slowdown because of page faults. And if you say the maximum I'm going to tolerate is a 10% slowdown, what kind of page fault probability should I expect? Okay, so you can simply solve that by just saying, so you have 1 minus P. It's the same every time I come here, this doesn't work. Yeah, that's the equation you basically need to solve. Well, this one is M here is 200 nanoseconds, and that is okay. And then this one is okay, so that's 220 is 200 minus 200 P plus. Okay, so that's 20 is. Okay, if you just ignore this quantity, just because if you take 200 out of 25 million, it's still close to 25 million, you're going to get. Okay. 20 over 25, let's just ignore. So this is approximately that probability. Okay? So very small. So that says 1 in a million instruction can fault if you want just a 10% slowdown. Okay, that's the probability of a page fault. So whenever you execute a million instruction, or at most one can fault if you want to limit it to 10%. So yes.
So that like common occurrence on the have a page fault rate, but that's not.
So that I would say is high. Typically you don't even want a 10% slowdown. So this is where the locality of reference is going to come to our aid. Okay? Because processes exhibit a huge amount of locality of reference, if you store the working set size, the probability of faults are going to be very small. You saw that on my machine, there's hardly any faulting at all. Yeah, typically, and that's even though a whole bunch of memory of these processes are still sitting on disk, because most of the processes or pages that they're accessing are already in memory. Only once in a while you go and access something else, so that works fine. Yeah, so page faults for processes are should be rare events to prevent non-trivial slowdown. Yeah, that's something to keep in mind. Okay, so let's talk about a few other mundane details you have to worry about when you implement page faulting, which is there is still a TLB and there are page tables and all of these things. So, and as I said, page tables have bits called valid bits that tell you whether that page is in memory or not. TLB will also have certain bits. Okay, so now whenever you have a page fault, you have to do several things. You fetch a page. You have to actually clear out, you have to create a new page table entry, you have to take that page table entry and update the TLB entry and so on. Okay? So these are, so there is a trap on a TLB miss. Okay, typically when you have a TLB miss, you are going to first check is the page in memory. If it's in memory, you fetch that page table entry and just stick it in the TLB, you're done. The page is not in memory, then you have a page fault. So first just bring the page from disk to memory, you update the page table. Then you take the page table entry and update the TLB entry and you are done. So there are cascading updates. Okay, so think of it as follows. Okay, so many data structures to worry about. Your disk, which is your virtual memory, or swap, your RAM, page table, TLB. Okay. Your pages here, your pages here, entries here and entries here. So whenever you look for do address dereference, you are first going to look here. Okay. If this is valid, then you basically just go and access the page, you are done. That's case one, fast path. Okay. TLB hit, page is resident in memory, nothing to do. Okay, so that case 2 is TLB miss. Okay, so page is not in the TLB. Okay, what you will do is say, is it still in the page table and is the page resident? Okay, so it's 2A, it says that this is a miss, but the page is still in memory, just that this entry was not in the TLB. So all you will do is you will bring it from here to here and you are done. Okay, so page resident. Okay, 2B says that it's not, the page table indicates that the page is actually not in memory. This is why it was a TLB miss. So then you fetch the page from here to here. Okay, you created a new page table. Brought in a new page. So you update this entry and then you bring that entry here. Okay. And then you are done. So you have the entry is in the TLB. The page table has been updated. The page is now resident in memory. Okay. So lots of these operations have to take place in order for the entire picture to still work. Okay, because there's still a TLB, there's still a page table which we have ignored so far. Okay, but whenever you service page faults, you have to go update all of them. Yes.
So it's like this idea of like demand paging. Like if you just access something that you're only going to use it once, as opposed to something you've been using constantly for like a long time, so you load it back into memory and back into a TLB. But if you're only going to use it once, it seems like it's slowing down the rest of the process.
If you only load it once, if you only access some page once, then you don't have good locality of reference. You will see poor performance. There is nothing we can be done about it. If you are on the one hand, you are demand paging and poor locality, you are asking for a lot of page fault and significant slowdown. Yeah, so well-behaved processes typically won't do that. It may be rare, yes.
In your slide, you said that you when you go to the TLB, you check the valid bit to see if it's in memory.
Yep.
When you explained it, can you ever have a situation where there is an entry in the TLB but the valid bit indicates that it's not in memory?
You're asking if there's a TLB entry here but the page is not in memory?
Yeah.
Typically you would not have that scenario because TLB is a cache for the page table. If it says that this is valid, then this bit also has to be valid. If that bit is valid, that means that the page is actually in memory.
Right, but I mean, can you ever have a TLB
entry for a page that isn't in memory. So
typically you would not have that, because when you flush, when you evict the page from memory, you are going to reset the page table entry and flush the TLB.
So you flush the TLB every time you evict the page?
Yes.
Okay. So why do we need to check the valid bit to see if it indicates the page is in memory?
That is the fast path, right? If the page is in memory, so if this is valid, then you basically can immediately just translate the address and you are done. That was case one, that's a TLB hit.
Right, but you just said that if it's in the TLB, then we already know it's in memory, so why do we ever have to check that valid bit?
That is how you check that, whether it is there or not. So you first check the entry, because it's associative cache, remember that. You first go and find the right entry, and then make sure that it's valid.
Okay.
So you might have an empty, you can... It's like a hash table entry where you have to first make sure there is an entry there at all, because it could just be an empty TLB slot.
Okay.
So you may actually not have it at all. So that's why you check that there's some, it's not garbage in that thing, and only then you will actually go and do.
Okay. So the valid bit there is not the same as the valid bit in the page table, which is indicating whether it is or isn't.
Yes. Here the valid bit just says, is there an entry there or not? Here the valid bit says, is the page in memory or not? Different in the notions of valid. Okay.
Thank you.
One is saying is the entry valid, the other one is saying is the page in memory. Yes, there's nuance there that I didn't make explicit. Okay. Now let's come back to some other nuances that you actually have to worry about. Okay. So you want paging to be transparent to a process. Okay. You want there will be a slowdown, but you don't want the process to do anything special just because the OS actually implements paging. Okay? And we'll see that there are actually scenarios where it's much harder to do implement paging when you have certain kinds of instruction. Okay? So here is the way we are going to service page faults. Whenever there is a faulting instruction, we are going to save the state of the process, service the page fault, bring the page in, and restart that instruction. Okay? So let's say the instruction was load an operand from memory. Yes, so when you try to dereference this memory address, you get a page fault. You save the state of the process, bring the page in, and you then re-execute this instruction. Okay, so this is how you are going to implement paging. Now there are certain instructions where when you re-execute the instruction, you may have side effects that you want to avoid. Okay, here is an example. Okay, so this assembly instruction says increment register 10, okay, and move that value of that register to memory address A. A typical assembly instruction that you will find. It says increment a register and store that value into some location. Okay. Now let's assume that the CPU is executing the instruction. So what's the CPU going to do? It's going to go and first increment the register, and then it's going to basically try to write it to memory region A. Okay. Now if that region belongs to location A belongs to a page that is not in resident in memory, you are going to get a page fault. Okay. So you will save the state of the process, you will bring the page in, and then you will try to execute that instruction again. Okay. Now if you just blindly execute that instruction, you will realize that you incremented that register twice. The first time there was a page fault, you executed it, and now you are going to do the same thing again. Okay. So there are certain instructions where you might have to unwind or undo that instruction in order to restart it. Otherwise, the program will not execute correctly. Okay, because simply, you are executing the instruction twice, and by doing that, you don't want to impact the correctness of the program. Okay. Loading something, a value into a register, is not going to be an issue. Okay, because you never even got the value in the first place. Incrementing a register and then storing it into a memory region is an issue. Okay. So you need a hardware to actually unwind the side effects. Okay. If there's a page fault, you need to be able to go and say, go back, decrement it, because when I re-execute, that's when you want to do it. Okay. That's the easy case. Okay. Look at this memory instruction, which is memory copies, block memory copies. In particular, you are doing a memory copy into an overlapping region. I'm saying that this memory region has to be copied to this memory region. Okay, so you're basically saying, and this could be of arbitrary size. You can say take this 1 megabyte of memory and copy it to this region. Okay, so you basically what you will do is you will go get the first page and you will copy it here, and the second page copy it here, and third page you copy it there, and so on. Okay, now let's say these are 10 pages, and when you are trying to copy the fifth page, you hit a page fault. Okay, you have already overwritten some piece regions of memory. You can't unwind that. Okay, because you took this region and you copied it there. How are you going to find what was in that memory region and restore it? You just cannot. Okay, is that clear what I said? If you are doing memory copies, of block memory copies, these are instructions that if in the middle of this instruction you hit a page fault, you are going to be in trouble. So you can't actually do this transparently, because once you have overwritten something, there's no way to get it back. Yes, your question.
You could pre-allocate, I guess, in a way. I mean, the solution kind of states that.
Right. So the only way to execute this instruction is to first check the entire range of memory addresses that this instruction hits and make sure that all of those are paged in before you start executing that instruction. If in the midst of executing an instruction you hit a page fault, you can't unwind this. Okay? This was the easy case. In the middle of an instruction you hit a page fault. You did half of the instruction, which is increment a register. Then when you try to do the other half, you hit a page fault. But it was okay to go back and decrement it. That's an operation you can unwind. Okay? Overwriting a memory region is not an operation you can unwind. Okay? So what you have to realize is that implementing virtual memory and demand paging is subtle. Okay, there are instructions that if you want to do this transparently, okay, you need to be able to do it carefully. There are certain instructions where you better make sure before you start that this is going to be okay, there won't be any page faults. Otherwise you will hit problems like this, okay, and you will have issues. That half the you can't actually leave the process where half of the instruction is executed. Okay, you can't even track which half. There's no way to say which half of the, and how will you resume executing. You have to only execute the entire thing again. Okay, so these are all issues to worry about. Okay, so now we leave it at that and move on to the next sort of subtopic, which is page replacement. Okay, so as I said, whenever there's a page fault, step one was select a page to evict. And I said that's done by the page replacement algorithm, and we said we will come back to it. So now let's talk about this. Okay, so you have a process, okay, and it's faulted. You want to bring in the faulted page, and to do that you have to evict a page. Okay, the question is which one you are going to evict. Okay, how do you pick this? Okay, so before we just say which one, I want to distinguish between two types of page replacement. They are called global page replacement and local page replacement. In global page replacement, when a page faults, you can cause any arbitrary page in the system to get evicted, even ones that belong to other processes. Okay? You bring in a page, you are allowed to evict any page from the system, rather than a wired page. So in this case, one process can actually impact the performance of another process. Okay? In local page replacement, a page fault can only evict a page of that process, but no other process. So what we are going to talk about here is local page replacement. Okay, but keep in mind that there are operating systems that will do global page replacements as well. And there are good reasons to do that. You might have a process that's ballooned in size and is hogging a whole bunch of memory. Okay, and it's not using that memory. When other processes are tiny, why actually have them evict their own pages when there's a lot of memory you can reclaim for this other process? So if you do global page replacement, you might get fairness across processes. And no process can take more than its undue share, yet processes can grow when they need to. Okay, but you can, vice versa, you can impact the performance of other processes. Whenever you are stressed, you will actually evict somebody's useful page and cause more problems. Okay, so we will not talk about global, we are only going to talk about local. Okay, so four policies. Okay, first one says random. Okay, process needs a page. Toss a coin, pick a page, throw it up. Okay, works well. Okay, it looks, feels like that's a really bad thing to do, but typically, random policies work reasonably well. Right? But we will not do random for the moment. We will look at three other policies. First one says first come, first serve. Throw the oldest page. So you basically have something called the age of a page. The age of the page says how long has it been sitting there. Is it 1 minute old? Is it 10 minutes old? 1 millisecond old? Throw out the oldest page. You're going to say this page is the oldest one. I'm going to throw it out. And the reason you might do that is say page I just fetched at the last page when I faltered previously. Because of locality of reference, I may be still using, but page that I got 10 seconds, I got 10 minutes ago, I'm willing to throw out. Okay? First come, first serve. Very simple policy. Okay? This is another policy called min. Okay? It's also an optimal policy. This policy says somehow look into the future, what this page is going, what this process is going to do, and throw out the page that it's going to access the farthest in the future. That's not going to need for the longest period of time. All the pages it's accessing, which is the page it's going to access last, and throw that one out. Okay? You can show that this policy is provably optimal. Okay? In the sense that this policy, if you could actually implement it, is going to give you the least page fault rate. Okay? But as you can imagine, unless you are an oracle, you are not going to be able to look into the future. Okay? You don't know what the process is going to do. Or if you had the crystal ball, you couldn't look at the future. Oracle, yes. Not Oracle, the company. If you are an Oracle.
Yeah.
If you are Oracle, not if you were Oracle. So it's probably optimal. Okay? And but the problem is this is like shortest job first. It says I need to know something about this process. In this case, I don't know the access pattern. Okay? So we are going to approximate, just as we took shortest job first and approximated it using MLFQ, we are going to take this policy called min, we are going to approximate it using what is called LRU, least recently. So what LRU says is we don't know what the future holds, but we don't know what the immediate past, what this process did. And if we assume that the near past is a reasonable predictor of the near future, and that's typically true because of locality of reference. Is that temporal locality? What does it say? Whatever I did right now, I'm likely to do again. Okay? So the performance in the near past is a good indicator of what the process is going to do. So I'm actually going to look at what the process has done in the past and throw out the page that's least recently used. That was accessed the farthest back in time in the past. Okay? So then that's the page I'm going to throw out. Okay? So this is called LRU policy. Okay, throw out the page that has not been used for the longest. Okay, keep in mind, LRU is different from FIFO. That says that's the oldest page. Okay, it doesn't matter what the process is doing in terms of accessing. Find the page that I brought in first among the pages I have in memory and throw that one out. That may still be a page the process is working on. I don't actually look at that. I just say it's old and I throw it out. This one says look at what the process is actually doing and throw the one that it has not accessed for the longest period. And that's actually better than FIFO, yes.
So is random actually better than FIFO?
It's random better than FIFO. I think random, you can claim reasonably well, is better than FIFO. Because FIFO doesn't actually look at the access pattern. Okay, random can, but we will not actually analyze FIFO. We are going to analyze the other three. Okay. So let's start with FIFO. Okay, three exercises to do here before you can go. Okay, we'll start with FIFO. So this is our RAM. Okay, we are going to take a toy system with three pages, three frames, frame 1, frame 2, frame 3. Okay, that has been allocated to a process. We'll say this process actually has four pages, A, B, C, D. Okay, and you allocated three frames to this process. So at any time, only three of those pages can be in memory. The fourth one has to be on disk. That's on virtual memory. Okay, and we are going to say this is the order in which instructions of this process actually access this pages. That's usually referred to as the reference stream of the process. That's a stream of pages it's accessing based on what it's executing. So if you access page A, some instruction accesses A, then B, then C, A, B, D. And that the stream will depend on what the process is actually executing. So for this reference stream, if you used FIFO, you have to ask what is resident in memory at any given time, how many page faults are you going to get? Okay? For this policy and that reference stream. Let's see if the problem is clear. Okay. Memory with three frames, process with four pages, FIFO policy and a reference stream that says that's the order in which this process actually accesses RAM. Okay, yes?
This is one of the off by one questions. Do we load them in initially? So the reference stream is the very first time?
Full demand paging. Okay, we'll assume the process starts at empty memory. Okay, and then we start warming up memory and bring in pages. Okay? So this is the purest form of demand paging. Okay, so I'm going to work here, not on the slide there. Okay. So first access is A. So this is the order. Okay, that's reference stream is actually shown here. Okay, so you access A, you ask, is A in memory? Okay, memory is empty, A is not in memory. Okay, so you're going to get A, that's a page fault. Okay. Next you access B, say is B in memory? It's not yet in memory. Okay, so you are going to fetch B, stick it into the second page. Okay, there's nothing to evict. We still have empty pages, so you're not going to evict anything yet. Okay, so you just bring in pages. Once you fill up memory, then you have a page fault, then you are going to evict something. Okay. Third access is C. Okay. So you are going to C is a page fault, as C is not yet resident in memory, so now your A, B, C is have arrived in RAM. Okay. Next access A. Okay. A is already there, so there's nothing to do. It's not a page fault. Then you have access B. B is still in memory, nothing to do. Okay. Then you come and access D. Okay, so the next two are not page faults. Okay, basically access D, that's going to be a page fault. Okay, now this is where page replacement is going to kick in. Okay, now you have to decide which one to throw out. Okay, and depending on the policy, you'll make different choices. So this one says FIFO. Throw the one that came in first. Okay, that one. Okay, if A, B, C, you say which one was brought in first. First come first, so you're going to evict this one. Okay, so it's going to be D, B, C. Okay. Then you access A. Okay, just evicted it unfortunately, so that's another page fault. And then you say of D, B, C, which one do you throw out? B. A is gone. Unfortunately, it's going to come back. Okay, so that's D, A, C. And then you access D, that's still in memory. B is evicted that, so B is going to come back in. Okay, and of these three, you say which one was brought in first? C. Okay, so I'm out of whiteboard space here, but then next one is C, that's another page fault. Okay, so you're going to throw out D because D came in first. Okay, so you basically bring last access is B, it's already in memory. So you can then count the number of page faults. I think there is going to be 7 or 8. Okay, so for that access stream, that's basically the contents of memory at any given time, and those are the page faults. Okay, so that's the easy case. That's FIFO. Okay, let's do min, which should hopefully do better for us. Okay, so same reference stream. Okay, different policy. Okay. First three accesses, there is no replacement. You're just bringing in the pages, there are still going to be page faults. So A, B, C come in, you're not doing much.
So do you track the ones that you've used? And so like each time they load it in, they count as one? So there's an implicit like one check mark on
these? What do you mean one? I'm not following the question.
You're counting how many times you've accessed each piece of memory, right?
This is just a reference stream. You're not counting how many times you access, you're just counting when you access the page, that's all you're counting. Okay, you can do additional counts, but we didn't actually look at that. Okay. So first three is not a page fault. Okay, then you access A. Is that a page fault?
No.
Okay, A is still there. Then you access B. B is good. Okay, then you access D. That is a page fault, like before. Okay, now you have to figure out which page to evict. Okay. So you are actually going to have to look into the future. You are actually going to look here and say, what pages do I have? A, B, and C. Which of these pages is going to be accessed for this in the future? A is accessed 1 time units later, B is accessed 3 time units later, and C is accessed 3 times. So this is the one you are going to throw. Okay, you are postponing your future page faults as much as possible. Okay. So you are going to say A, B, D. Okay, C is the one that goes out here. So in doing so, A is still in memory, D is you just brought it in, B is still here, and then the next page for it is going to happen here. Okay. Yes?
If a page gets loaded in, it needs to sit there at least for one iteration of the page load queue, right? Like, you wouldn't load D and then immediately unload it because it's accessed.
Right. So keep in mind that this is not in, these are not instructions. These are the order in which individual pages are getting access. Right. So you bring in page A. That's 4 kilobytes in size. You may have 1,000 instructions. Okay. So the next 1,000 instructions you'll just execute. Just keep on accessing A, and you're fine. Right. So then maybe some operand accesses B, and that's how you access it. So don't think of this as one assembly instruction. This is the first time the process has actually touched A. The next time it touches some other page, that's what we are capturing. What pages is the process touching? Okay. So there may be between A and B, there may be lots of touches to A which we have not put in here. Okay, we just counted it as one access.
This algorithm is working in the future, so it's not including pages based on all monthly views.
Right, so he is just asking what is happening within a page.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Is that clear?
Yeah.
Okay. So these are not instructions. These are just page accesses, and we are just assuming these are distinct page accesses. Okay, so that's all we are doing. So this one requires us to look in the future, and by doing that we have reduced the number of page faults to just 4 or 5. Okay, the first 3, then D comes in, and then when C is brought in, we don't have enough history, so you can throw out whatever you want other than B. Okay, so because the process terminates here. Okay, but that's a page fault. That's a page fault first. So it is down to 5 from 8 or 9. Okay, and that is optimal in this case. Okay, and this should give you an insight by looking into the future and say which is the page I'm going to access last. You are basically deferring the next page fault until that point, because you are saying next there those many pages are not going to fault because I'm going to keep them in memory. Okay, so you keep trying to postpone page faults as much as possible, and that is why you get this optimal feature. Okay, last is LRU, and then we'll stop. Okay, so same thing happens for the first 3. So you bring in the first 3 pages. Okay, now you don't have knowledge of the feature, you can only look in the past. Okay, and A is accessed, it's in memory. B is accessed, still in memory. You come to D and say now you have a page fault. So now you look backwards and do the same thing. Which is the page that was accessed the farthest in the past? Okay, so you say B was accessed here one time unit ago, A was accessed 2 time units ago, and C was accessed. So between A, B and C is the one that you access the last. Okay, so you actually evict C. Okay. Now this example is carefully concocted so that LRU and OPT will do the same thing. Typically you may not get that, because if you just swap this order, you had B, A, C, you would have actually gotten a different thing. But in this case you actually throw out C. Okay, and so you basically get A, B, D. Okay, at this point. Okay, and then you access A, that's fine. You access D, that's fine. You access B, that's fine. And that's another page. Okay, now you again look in the past and say which one to throw out. Okay, so if this is a page fault, which between A, B and D, which one will you throw out?
A.
Okay, so you have to throw out A because that was accessed 3 time units ago. You're done. Okay, so in this case, LRU has matched the performance of optimal, without knowing requiring any. So it's an approximation, it's not always going to match, obviously. It'll do a little worse than OPT, but because of locality of reference, we are going to win. Yeah, the near past is going to look like the near future. Okay? So those are the 3 policies we'll look at. We'll not do random. Okay, random is very easy. Okay, so which one to throw out, you toss a coin. Okay, there's no answer that's wrong for random, actually. Small stink. Right. Okay, so this is where we will stop. And okay, there's one more thing, but I'll come back to that example next time. Okay, so.